All right, it is January 30th, 2013, and I'm sitting with Larry Basinger. Larry, you were associated with WHAS radio and television, or basically radio?
Briefly television. I spent most of my career in AM and FM radio.
And that career began at WHAS in?
1964.
You were a young lad and ready to roll.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah.
Well, how did you come to that point? Let's talk about that for just a minute. Were you always interested in electronics, or what had that appetite?
Well, it's a sad tale of woe, and I'll lead you right through it. As a kid, I was more or less homebound most of the time. I was kind of a sickly youth, and I'm a product of the radio generation. Radio was our entertainment.
Tell me about that. You grew up listening to the radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Television was there, but not, well, not
television very much. Was just coming in.
Yeah. So this was in the early 50s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I grew up listening to the radio dramas was the big thing for me. I always enjoyed those. In fact, that's what led me into broadcasting in general. I wanted to be a sound effects man.
Ah.
Because I was fascinated by all the sound
effects.
The
inner sanctum of the
door.
Yeah,
oh, golly, all these wonderful shows. And so I spent most of my youth listening to and trying to figure out how all of these things were done in order to sound authentic when broadcast on the radio. I went to Aaron's Trade, Technical Trade School, high school.
You were here in Louisville.
Here in Louisville.
You grew up in Louisville.
And got into radio and television servicing, because that was the big industry of the time, repairing TVs.
Oh, yeah.
You were pretty much guaranteed a reasonably good
income
doing that. So as a result of that, I also got my ham radio license.
What age did you get your ham radio license?
I think I was probably 13 or 14 when I got my ham radio license.
You remember the first time you went on the air with
a
ham radio?
Oh, yeah.
Or who you talked to, or where they were, or anything? Was it local, or was it somewhere?
Yeah, it was about 4 blocks away from where I lived, as a matter of fact.
Did that surprise you, or were you looking for somebody on the other side of the world?
No, that was another of my high school buddies.
Okay.
He had just gotten his license as well, so that was our big communications. And then probably shortly thereafter, I ended up talking to some people in Europe, because this was in probably about 56 or 57, and at that time, the sunspot cycle was at its greatest for that period of time, and propagation conditions were terrific. You could span the world with very low power. So it got to be a real challenge to see how many countries that you can reach with low power. Of course, we were doing Morse code, CW.
Oh.
Voice transmission can't hold a candle to code transmission as far as distance is concerned, depending on conditions.
Because of the signal?
So that was the big thrill of ham radio, was pursuing all of these foreign countries. And
you know how many you reached? I'm sure you kept a record of that, didn't you?
Oh, I think I probably had, when I finally got out of that particular phase of it, I had probably reached 40, 45 countries, I think.
Wow.
Which
I will talk a little later about, I don't know if that had an influence, but I know you went to several Latin American or South American countries and helped put up radio stations.
Yeah, sure did.
That had an influence on it, probably.
That was another fun period.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little later. Yeah.
Already? Mm-hmm. So anyway, my interest was sparked by listening to radio and listening to the radio dramas. And
favorite shows?
Golly, Inner Sanctum was always a big one.
Always speaking of sound effects. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because
the door opened, the creaking door.
Yeah, that thing was rife with gunshots and screams. And
Did you ever, were you ever around a studio where they did that? Did
no,
you ever watch them do
not
that?
Not until I went to work for WHAS.
Really?
Yeah, which was kind of strange. Now, most of the radio dramas at that time was being carried by the CBS radio network.
Yeah.
And WHAS was the CBS O&O here in, well, they weren't owned by them, but they were the key
affiliate,
station
yeah,
for them.
Affiliate, yeah, mm-hmm. Affiliate. 50,000 watt station.
50,000 watt station. And growing up through my teen years and early 20s, I listened to WHAS all the time, coming and going to school and, you know, the whole thing. And never dreaming that I would ever actually pursue a career in radio.
Oh, that was not a particular goal.
No. I wanted to be in radio, and I wanted to be in the sound effects end of it, but I figured you had to go to New York or you had to go to L.A. or someplace like that where the networks originated all this stuff. And being somewhat strapped for cash most of the time, I didn't see that happening right away. I was not going to do that. So I ended up, by my interest in ham radio more than anything else, getting into broadcast engineering in order to work on some big transmitters instead of the little toy transmitters that we were playing with.
Did you build toy transmitters?
Oh,
not
sure.
Toy, but I mean, you built your transmitters and your sets and all that.
And that was another interesting thing, too, because during the 50s, there was an awful lot of military surplus radio equipment available.
From World War II?
Yeah. And, well, almost in the Korean vintage stuff was available, too. And the Lexington, Kentucky Signal Depot was charged with reconditioning a lot of military equipment. And that which wasn't economically rebuildable, they would periodically sell off at auction. They would have, I think, a twice yearly auction at Lexington. Actually, over at Richmond, I think, is where the warehouse was for this. And so several of us teenage ham aspiring engineers would band together and pool our resources and buy enough gasoline to go down there and spend a Saturday and buy up everything we could find in the way of surplus equipment and then bring it home and carefully dissect it, hoping to revive some of it. And if it wasn't revivable, at least get a really good accumulation of parts from which you could build something else. So my early ham radio stations were built entirely from military surplus stuff.
How about that?
Which was a lot of fun. My very first receiver was actually an aircraft radio receiver. From a series called the ARC 5 series, Aircraft Radio Corporation Series 5. Mm-hmm. And these were little compact units that plugged into a framework. And most of the bigger aircraft would carry three or four of these units, three or four receivers, three or four or five transmitters, and they all plugged into racks, and they were all powered by the aircraft's DC power supply systems. So it was really fascinating. I tried to collect the whole series. I think finally, after a number of years, I got a sample of each of the radios in the series. But as I say, the first receiver I used for ham radio purposes was one of the ARC 5 military receivers. And the first transmitter, I never got one of the military transmitters working. So I had enough scrapped out parts that I could build a transmitter from, and that was the first one. Along about that time, Heathkit.
Oh, yes.
the saver of many a project, Heathkit, came out with a couple of amateur radio, ham radio units, one of which was a little, I think it was rated as a 20 or 25 watt transmitter. And it was called the AT1.
AT1.
Amateur transmitter number one.
Got it right down to the basics.
And I think it was like $29.95 in kit form. And they later became known as Benton Harbor Wonder Boxes because they were made in Benton Harbor, Michigan, or at least that's where Heathkit was was at the time. So that was my second transmitter. And I stayed with that thing for a number of years. It was very serviceable, very reliable. And then later on, when I got the urge to actually be heard and talk, I built an AM transmitter. And as I recall, I think it was about 100 watts or maybe 100.
What age were you then when you did that?
Probably 16, 17, somewhere along in there. That I stayed with that for years and years and years as well. My ham radio career is kind of convoluted because I would get active for a period of time and go at it hot and heavy and then get interested in music or something else, and it would kind of go by the wayside for a while.
Yeah,
but I always came back to it.
That was your basic then.
Yep, and I figured that was probably my best training ground of all was ham radio, because you learn by doing. It's not something out of a book. It's not a theory. It's, you know, you learn how to do it, and then you read up on as to what the
did
theory.
I do it? Yeah,
yeah,
right.
You know, how
that's
does
why
this
that
work?
Works. That's why
exactly.
That works.
But that was fun. That was the fun part of
well,
it.
Well, good. And so that began to parlay. Was WHAS your first radio job?
No. As a matter of fact, I went to work for a little station that was called WLRP.
WLRP, was that in Louisville?
Nope, that was in New Albany.
Huh.
It was located over on Silver Street, on top of a hill in New Albany. It was a little 1,000-watt daytime AM station. And I had been involved in recording programs at our church that aired on this station on Sunday morning.
Now, when was this? What year was this? It was probably in the early 60s or something?
No, this had to be probably 58, somewhere along in there. So I knew where the station was because I had to deliver the tapes to them so that they could air them on Sunday morning. So I got to talking to some of the staff there, and I discovered they didn't have a full-time engineer. When something went wrong, they had to hire somebody to come in and repair it. So I got really chummy with several of the folks, and I said, you know, I'd really like to have a job. I've got a license. You know, by that time I had gotten my first class.
You're pretty young to have that, weren't you?
Yeah. But, you know, I was interested in stuff then.
Yeah, but still.
So they said, well, I'll let you talk to our general manager, Woody Delaney. Now, Woody had been with WAVE for a number of years, and he was kind of wanting to get away from the pressure of the larger station's operations, so he had taken over as general manager of this little daytimer. So I went in and talked to Woody, and he found out that I was interested in ham radio and had done this, that, and the other, and he said, well, if you've got a license, he said, I need for you to take care of the transmitter. That's the biggest thing right now. You have to take care of that transmitter. And I said, oh, shoot, I can do that. You know, I know all about that transmitter, and knowing absolutely nothing about that transmitter. You know, when you're young, you can do those things.
But you knew you could figure it out.
Why, sure.
Even if you had to rely on a book. Somewhere.
Exactly. So I became chief engineer for, I think it was the grand sum of $75 a week. Now, one of the things the chief engineer had to do was also sign on the station on Sunday morning and sort of ride herd on all the religious programs that were aired. So I got a little taste of being able to give the station ID and read the weather and this sort of thing in between shows. And man, this is nice.
I
kind of like this. You know, this is sort of like ham radio, but better.
Yeah. So, all my friends can hear this.
Exactly. So later on, at that time they were still playing the down home format type of local radio, and they had taped programs. They didn't carry any network programs, but they did carry network news. I was trying to think what the affiliation was, but it's been so long ago I've forgotten now, but. Along about that time, a young fellow by the name of Reed Yaden paid a visit to the station one day, and he said, these folks need a really good newsman.
He was a youngster, too, like
you. Oh, yeah.
He was a very young guy.
Yeah. And I said, yeah, we do. We've got a newscaster who, you know, like network news was done in those days. He would come in and tear all the news off of the wire, off the teletype, and spend about an hour in his office editing and putting together a 5-minute newscast out of all this stuff. And when it came time for the news, he would present it in typical stentorian tones, you know, and just like the good old days of radio. Well, Woody Delaney, the station manager, said, you know, this is old-timey. This is old timey. We've got to update this thing. So he applied for and got the call sign WOWI. Wowie. So we became Wowie Radio.
Wowie Radio. I hadn't heard that.
We were in competition with Wacky.
Oh yes, W A K Y.
Since that was what was really big in radio at the time, Wowie had to sound like Wacky. So Reed got the job as newsman because he could do that staccato delivery of the newscast.
Change, yeah.
Yeah. And I got to be a DJ for a short period of time.
How about that?
And
you liked that, huh?
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
Sure.
I enjoyed that. So that was my introduction to radio. So,
as a DJ, you spun the records. You had records.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 45s.
Sure.
That's
yeah.
The vinyl days, you know. Everything from the library. And we'd bring them in. We had two spindles, and we'd stack up a spindle full of records. And as you played them, one by one, you'd put them over on the empty spindle until it
so
was
that was
full.
Your program. That
and
was
then
your
you
show.
You rotated it back again and ran through the whole thing.
Did you have a top 40 type thing where you had a certain amount? That's those are the records you played.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Exactly.
Nothing else. Nobody could call and say.
Whatever was on the chart,
that's what you did.
That's
I see. And they played them over and over. Sure, that was what top 40 was. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Real easy, you know. So that was fun, but the pay never got any better. And by that time, I was courting a young lady and anticipating a big change in life, and I decided maybe I better have something a little better in the way of prospects here before I go talk to Papa, you know. So I had heard that there was an engineering position open at WAKY. So
and they were a big gun. Then.
They
I
were a big gun.
Very popular.
They were
what, a 5,000 watt station?
Yeah,
really? 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a pretty good signal.
And between them and WKLO, they had the market pretty well tied up.
Yeah.
They were both top 40 stations and going really well. So I went over and talked to the chief engineer. Wycliffe Morrison was his name. And I said, you know, I'd really like to have a better paying job is what I'm looking for. And, you know, I've got transmitter experience. I've got limited air experience. I'm not really all that interested in pursuing that because I'm not one of these fast-paced DJ-type people. But I would be interested in engineering. And he said, well, we've got two positions in engineering. We've got a studio engineer position, and we've got a transmitter engineer position. And I said, well, what's entailed in these things? Well, the studio engineer actually plays the records that the disc jockey on the other side of the glass announces and does his thing. And they had a separate newsman and a separate news booth.
And you would operate those while
And you would sit there at the big console, big Gates console. Oh, my, I was impressed. And that was your thing. Well, I did that for a short period of time, and it was interesting. It was fun. But
what were some of the DJs you worked with?
Oh golly, yeah. There was Hal Smith. There was. I wish you hadn't asked me that.
This in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, early 60s.
Yeah. Wacky was really booming.
Oh yeah. And about that time, Reed Yaden also applied for and got a job as a newsman there at Wacky. So we had some we kind of followed each other around.
I didn't realize that. And, Bill Bailey wasn't at Wacky.
No, Bill wasn't there at the time.
Later.
He came in later. Jumpin' Jack Sanders was the big one there at the time. And I got to work with Jack for a while.
What was that like, working with somebody like that? With
frantic.
Top 40 disc jockey, yeah.
Frantic. That was frantic.
In what way? He
was strictly off the wall. You never knew what he was going to do, and it was almost impossible to anticipate. And when we weren't pulling an air shift as such, we also did production recording.
Yeah.
And doing production recording with him was a real hoot too. Because
so you would operate while he was doing the commercials
and
put them together.
Yep. And he had the annoying habit of reading everything on the page. So when it come time for him to do a commercial, he'd start at the top and run to the bottom. And if it happened to say next page at the bottom, that became part of the dialogue that you had to go back and edit out.
Wow.
But that was fun. Those were fun days.
How long were you there?
I stayed there. Well, at the studio, I was there for about a year and a half. And then I found out that the transmitter engineer job paid a whole lot better. So I asked the chief engineer if I could fill the transmitter engineer position that was still open. And he agreed, so I stayed another 3 years, 2.5, 3 years at the transmitter, and worked the quote-unquote swing shift.
Which was?
We had three shifts that we rotated through.
Sure, somebody had to be at the transmitter all the time.
24 hours a day, because mm-hmm. they were on the air. So that got to be interesting, too, because you never knew what meal was next, whether you were doing breakfast, dinner, supper, whatever.
Sure. So you worked different shifts then.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And the transmitter plant was located out in Jeffersontown. And in the wintertime, that was kind of interesting getting out there off Taylorsville Road. We didn't have any of the improvements then. We didn't have the Snyder Freeway or any of that stuff. So you would always take a stash of food and keep at the transmitter, because come a heavy snow, you couldn't get out and the relief guy couldn't get in.
Wow. So that happened often?
Yeah, in the wintertime that happened quite often. The plant was really kind of unique. It was built back in the days when a transmitter plant had to be maintained and manned, and they usually had two or three engineers on each shift. By the time I had gone there, it was down to you're it.
One man. The towers? I don't think they're still there. The towers aren't still there.
Yes,
are they?
There's four.
Just off the Snyder and Taylorsville Road.
That's mm-hmm. where four towers.
Yeah, right.
In a parallelogram.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Those aren't the original towers. Those were replaced about 20 years ago.
But same site.
Yeah, same site. So in our little kitchenette we had back there.
They had a building that you could
have. Oh, yeah. It's a concrete block building. Yeah. Nice. Had a bedroom. Mm-hmm. Had a full bath with shower. Had a kitchen.
Just in case.
Had a nice big workshop facility with power tools. Wow. Because this is during the period of time when you had to manufacture a lot of parts. You couldn't get a lot of pieces for these big transmitters back then, especially the older transmitters, because the manufacturers didn't really support them all that well. Mm. So we had a nice shop where you could do a lot of work, and I enjoyed that. I worked out there until I got word that there would be a vacancy soon at WHAS, that big powerhouse down the street, you know.
Had a reputation.
Oh, golly, yeah. So I went over and talked to Joe Fox, who was the assistant chief engineer at that time. And well, he was there well after I went to work for them. But Joe was an interesting fellow because he was a ham radio operator. So we had an instant rapport. Joe was probably in his early 60s when I went over there. I was 22.
Yeah, Joe was, I never met Joe. Joe was gone by the time I came in 73. But you'd be surprised how many of the old-timers asked me if I was Joe's son.
Yeah, I can see.
Fox, are you Joe's son?
Joe was a great boating enthusiast. He had a boat on the river all the time. And in fact, he practically lived there. That was his thing. That and ham radio.
So you went for an interview? Is that what you did?
Went for an interview.
Where was that held? Well, you were in the Courier Journal.
At the Courier Journal building.
At 6th and Broadway.
Yeah. Up on the 5th floor. All mm-hmm. the executive offices were on the 5th floor.
Well, what did you feel like walking in there that day?
I was worth $1 million. I'm telling you.
Newspapers there, and it's big and powerful. Oh, yeah. The radio and television station were there.
I didn't go in the front door. The front door, revolving doors, led into a rotunda.
Yes.
And there was this huge globe suspended from the ceiling that rotated.
Covering the world.
Yeah, covering the world. I went in the side door, the employee entrance. And of course was met by the security people there, and you know, who are you and where are you going? Well, I'm going for a job interview. I'm somebody. He did have to tell me where it was and how to find it, but I got there and interviewed with Joe, and he said, well, you've got the necessary qualifications, I think. He said, now we a new man always has to start out in a rather menial position, because after all, we have a staff of 53 engineers.
53 engineers mm-hmm. for radio and television.
For radio and television.
Wow.
And he said, and of course, you would be probably the youngest man on the
this
staff
is
if you take
1964, and you're 21 years.
21 or 22, yeah. And he said, you'll be the kid. You know,
because some of those guys had been there for years.
Oh, yeah, they were Second World War veterans for the most part. In fact, the radio supervisor, Carl Nielsen, Colonel Carl Nielsen, had been in the Signal Corps during the Second World War. Paul Devine, who you knew, was a major. Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys had left radio and gone into the service, and then when they came back from the service, they were.
Now, well, this was a big time deal.
Oh,
WHAS
yeah.
and the Courier Journal. That was a very big deal.
Absolutely. So he said, "Well, when can you start?" I said, "When do you need me?" And he said, "Next Monday, 6:00."
A.M.
yeah. All right, sir, I'll be there. So that was my introduction to Colonel Carl Nielsen.
How about that?
Who was the radio master supervisor. Okay, master control was located on the 6th floor. Radio master control was located on the 6th floor. TV was on the 7th floor. The offices and the cafeteria. You wanted to learn that real quick. That was located on the 5th floor.
That was really a community there, that Courier Journal building, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big operation. And as mentioned in Credo Harris's book, we'll get to that a little later, the building was actually divided in half with an acoustic separator to keep the vibrations from the printing presses from getting over into the studio and office areas. So it was really kind of interesting when the presses were running late in the afternoon.
Oh, yeah, they had two editions, morning and afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And in the late afternoon, though, when they would fire up the presses down there, if you were over in the studio side of the building, everything was nice and calm. If you walked down the hall and crossed the sound barrier into the back area, suddenly you hear this roaring, rumbling sensation.
So it was actually designed that way.
Yeah, it was designed that way.
Was that building? That building was built in. They were in radio and newspaper at the same time when that building was built.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, they had been in another building at 3rd and Liberty Streets.
Was the newspaper over there at 3rd and Liberty also? Or?
The newspaper that was the Louisville Times.
Okay.
Then they didn't start the second paper, the Courier Journal, until they moved to the 6th and Broadway location.
That.
But
when did they move to that 6th and Broadway? Do you recall?
You know, I really don't know. I'll have to look it up. I probably got it here buried away in the goodies. But that my first impression of the place was, and it was almost a spiritual thing.
Sure.
You know, to walk into that building at night, because later on I was transferred to
activity.
The place was never dark. I mean, there was always somebody there. But to walk in there at night. And ride up to the 6th floor and get off the elevators. There was a little lobby there when you get off the elevators. Only 4 of the 6 elevators went to the 6th floor. The executive elevators, of course, they all the way up to the top. But to get off the elevator there, and it's absolutely quiet, just deathly quiet, not a sound to be heard anywhere. Go walk down the corridor, open the master control room door, and walk in. And here's all this, you know, cacophony of sound. You got programs running. You got programs being queued up. You got people practicing. It was just.
Were they doing much? Were they still doing some live? They were still doing some live in studio stuff, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Well, do you remember what some of that was?
Because I was involved in some.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, we still did Jim Walton's Waxworks, mm-hmm. which was a predecessor of DJ type of radio there. As I said, they moved kicking and screaming into the 20th century. It took a long time for Top 40 radio to ever permeate and get over to HAS. But Jim Walton's Waxworks, they did, pop music, Peggy Lee, that
He sat in a studio, and then somebody like you played the records.
Well, it was interesting. The studio that it was done out of, Jim Walton's Waxworks, was actually a big production. It was a live and recorded type of thing. he would always have one or more guests on his show in the mornings, and sometimes musicians to accompany one or more guests in the morning. So his show was done out of Studio A, which was the largest radio studio up there. It housed the big Kilgan organ that was pipe organ that was down
the pipe organ in the radio.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, that was that was top of the line. You had a pipe organ. And Herbie Cook was still there then and played. He had a show in the afternoons and played organ and recited poetry. It was
how about that?
It was interesting.
This is in the middle 60s, yeah. Still. Yeah, wow.
So the
Jim it was Walton's like an island to itself.
Yeah,
there,
it
really
was. And to do a radio show there at that period of time was like doing a television show today. Studio A was this enormous studio, acoustically treated, cork floors.
Wow.
Adjacent to was the main control room. Okay. To the right of the control room was the producers and director's booth. Above that, at a, you know, like 8 feet, nine yeah. feet above, was the client's booth, because sponsors in those days liked to see their commercials being done.
They were done live. They were done
indeed,
live.
Indeed. Wow. So you had a client's booth, you had a producer director booth,
client's booth,
you
had the engineering booth. And
yeah.
tables.
Oh,
and,
yeah. It was posh. Wow. It was amazing. And in order to do the audio end of it, you had one man on the audio console. He was the switcher, okay? You had one man on turntable. He was the record man. You had one man who had a remote control box that controlled four tape machines. They were located way to heck and gone down the hall in Radio Master. So before every show, it was his responsibility to go and cue up each of the tapes that would be needed during that show. And if there were more tapes than four that would be needed, somewhere during the operation of the show, he'd have to run down the hall and change tapes.
What would be on the tapes? Would just be music or interviews?
It could be music. It could be a delayed newscast. It could be all kinds of things. Little featurettes would be on tape. All the music, recorded music, would be on transcriptions, and sometimes 16-inch diameter transcriptions. Once in a while, occasionally, but not all that often, a regular 12-inch vinyl disc would be used. But most all of the music at that time came from our music library and had been transcribed onto these big discs.
So somebody had gone into a studio and played the music, and they had basically made the records.
Yep. Wow. Yep. So, I mean, it was like network radio.
Sure,
I was just, in seventh heaven. Big-time radio man.
Unbelievable. I can see why they had 53 engineers right there. Oh, yeah. Probably a little short-handed sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it got handled.
Now, were they on the air? Radio was on 24 hours then, or just?
No, it went off at midnight, came back on at 5. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I often wondered about that.
Yeah.
It didn't seem very economical to do that, but that's the way it operated in those days. Oh. Well, I think at one time it was dictated by necessity. You needed 4 or 5 hours of maintenance time.
For all that equipment.
Yeah. So that made sense to do that.
And all these studios and tape rooms, they were all connected with wires running
under
the floors.
Yeah,
and that was an engineer's responsibility also install that and maintain it.
And we had a separate crew of engineers that did maintenance. That's all they did. The operating engineers, quote unquote, I was fortunate enough to be one of to begin with. Later on, I went into maintenance, and that got to be work. The fun went out of it real quick. But while we were on the operating staff, that was really fun.
When you started that first morning, were you on the operating staff then? What did you do that day? Do you remember
that?
That
first day, I followed people around to see what they did. They're not going to trust the kid with anything responsible. Hey, kid, go get a microphone out of the closet. You know, that sort of thing.
You remember who were some of the people you worked with?
Oh, Harold DeArmond. You remember Harold? He was with us over in the other building. Harold Cox.
Mm-hmm.
Shorty Newman,
mm-hmm.
Charlie Newman, you remember him?
Yeah.
Paul Devine, people like that. Now, Paul was never in operations, but Charlie Newman was, Harold Cox was, Harold DeArmon was. In fact, Harold DeArmon was the audio man. You've got a problem, you go see Harold. He'll tell you how to fix it.
Yeah.
And one of the things about operating out of that big studio, Studio A, and I was going to mention that, it was standard procedure that before every show, even though you did this show 5 days a week, out of the same studio 5 days a week, at the same time 5 days a week, you tore the studio down after each show, took all the equipment out, put it away. Mic stands, microphones, copy holders.
That's pretty involved.
You stripped the whole, and this was the operating engineer's responsibility to do this. Which meant, hey, boy.
Is that because each show had different requirements?
Yeah, because that studio would be used throughout the day for other things. But so you'd go in, if the show was to air at 6, you know, you'd get there at 5, go down to the microphone closet and get the microphones out, bring them up to the studio, go over to the other storage closet, get the mic stands. And these were huge boom stands like they use in television nowadays.
Wow.
I don't know, but that's what we had. Well, because occasionally they would have a pretty good sized band in that studio, and you'd have to mic them, you know, from a distance. But being the new guy, that was my job. And Harold DeArmon would give me a list of what he wanted for that setup that day, and so I'd go down, check them off the list, get the mics he wanted, and get the mic stands.
How about that?
Go out and set up the studio, and he'd come out and, that's right. Okay, you want to move that cable? You know, somebody will trip over that.
Wow.
Very meticulous about
Very
it.
Very elaborate.
Set the studio up. Then at that time we had a separate music library, which was down on the fifth floor. So supposedly, sometime during the night, the music librarian would bring this wheeled dolly up with all the transcriptions in it and all the tapes in it and three or four copies of the script for the show. And hopefully that was there when you got there, because if it wasn't, you're going to have a fine time trying to find all this
scripts
stuff.
For the show.
Is oh, yeah.
A producer would do that?
Oh, yeah. Everything was scripted. Yeah, absolutely. No ad-libbing. You can't have that.
Yeah.
That's no good.
It was great stuff, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And
so this was sort of like what you listened to as a kid.
Yeah.
You were right in the middle of it.
So then. I made it. I'd made the big time.
Did they have sound effects people? They have
no, but but they still had the sound effects equipment.
And
I stumbled across that in one of the closets, the storage closets, that was in the hallway between Studio A and Studio C. A was the largest, B was the next largest, C was the smallest, and then you had D, E, and F studios.
Oh,
these were like maybe as big as this room here, 12 by 12,
yeah.
Something
oh.
like that. And those were considered announce booths.
That's a big
space. They thought on a grand scale.
Yeah, they really did. Yeah.
And each of these studios had, you know, the double glass windows in the control room adjacent to it, because you always had an engineer do everything. The talent was talent.
Just you know? Walked in and that's it.
Yeah. They read the papers,
yeah.
Which
How
was
about
fun.
That?
But that was that was fascinating. I
sure.
really.
Who was
really
the station manager at that time? Do you have a
Victor Scholes?
Okay.
Yeah, Victor Scholes.
Head over everything, radio and television.
Yeah. Yep.
Who was the radio manager? Do you remember who? Probably had several there.
Well, yeah, there were several on and off. The chief engineer, of course.
See why that was a big responsibility, the chief engineer.
Yeah. Orrin Towner. He was.
You remember who the news director, some of the news people were?
Bill Small at one time.
Who went on to become
CBS.
Yeah.
It was kind of a revolving door. There was a lot of them.
People, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And a lot of news people,
mm-hmm.
newsmen, even though they were a lot of women.
And as big as it was, and as important as it was, this was also sort of a stepping stone for New York or Chicago or some place
absolutely.
Like that. If you worked at WHAS then.
You had credentials.
Yeah, right.
It was good. And in connection with that, part of Walton's Waxworks show in the morning, that thing was at least an hour long, maybe longer. I don't recall now. But anyway, in the show, there was a segment, a news segment. So you had to change gears right in the middle of the show to do a newscast. And these, I think they were about 10-minute long newscasts then. And what would happen is, in comes another rollaway table, mm-hmm. stacked up with these 10 and 12 inch transcriptions. Every news actuality was cut into a disc.
Which is a report from Libya or someplace.
Or even Joe Schmo on the street, yeah. You know, whomever. But if it was an audio actuality, it was recorded and cut into a disc.
And put into the script.
And it was scripted where it was going to be played back. The disc number, the cut number, because there would be, you know, 15, 20 cuts on this disc. And inevitably, even though this stuff is brought up in plenty of time to have it all ready for the newscast, if you were the unlucky so-and-so who happened to be on turntable, it was your responsibility to match up the news cuts with the actuality.
It could get interesting.
And it could get very interesting because especially usually at the last minute, just before time for a newscast, newsman would come running in with an addition.
It's the latest news, breaking news. Yeah, right.
And throw down two or three discs and a piece of paper, you know, and you've got to find out, which one is which and where does it... and try to get the silly thing queued up at the right time.
Wow.
But that was fun.
That was really fun. Wow. Now, this was all in the middle 60s. You went there in 64. Uh-huh. How long did it continue like that? Now, let's see. That was the time you were getting ready to transition to the new building.
To the new building.
New building then at 6th and Chestnut.
Yes. Uh-huh.
At Chestnut Armory Place. So you were involved in that, obviously.
Yeah. In fact, by that time, I had gotten involved in some television as well. And my first experience with the new building was unpacking and testing out all of the TV monitors that would be used in the control rooms in one of the big shops. We had a huge shop area in the basement, and I had workbench after workbench after workbench stacked up with TV monitors plugged in and running
to make sure
that they would burn.
Well, you saw that building, which is still in operation today with WHAS television.
Yes.
You saw that literally from the ground up.
Sure did. Sure did. And that was
run some wires and help do some things up there.
Yeah, a whole lot of them.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a little story about that too. Paul Devine was the maintenance supervisor, even in the old building at the Courier building. And when the new building was under construction, Paul Devine was given the chore of making sure that everything was wired state-of-the-art. So we had these massive blueprints of wiring troughs where everything would be, where each wire and cable, every wire was numbered.
Wow.
Every cable was numbered. Every run was numbered. You had to have a scorecard to play the game. I mean, when it came time to
no rookies in here. No rookies in here.
That was fun. So this was 67, early 67, when we started building that building. So I was working part-time at the studio still and part-time over at the building helping in the transition of moving equipment.
All part of your, like, eight-hour shift?
Yeah.
Or you didn't come in and do one and do three?
No. The union wouldn't hold for that.
The union was very strong. It wasn't the first, but that kind of...
Yeah. That was the big attraction of going there in the first place was the union salary for engineers.
And that was...
big money.
Were there any other... I guess Wave was sort of on
Wave
that
was,
scale.
Yeah, so. Wave was initially we were with NABET,
mm-hmm.
National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians, and then it became IBEW, mm-hmm. International Broadcasting, and that's a whole different story too. The union negotiations is.
Were you involved in union negotiations?
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah, a couple of times and. It was a learning experience. Let's put it that way.
Huh.
Yeah, you develop a deep appreciation for independence. But I digress.
While were you digressing? Let's talk for just a minute because the Bingham family, of course, owned radio and television. What was the atmosphere like there with the Bingham family? Did you have much contact with the family itself, or?
Yes and no. It was kind of a almost like the royal family type situation there. You know?
Was Mr. Bingham Barry Sr., was he still pretty much involved?
Oh, yes.
Time?
Yeah, very, very much so. Barry Jr. was being groomed at that time to take over. In fact, they started Barry Jr. working in the newspaper, and he worked in just about every area of the newspapers at one time or another before transitioning over to the radio side.
Was there one daughter? Did they have one or two daughters?
Three daughters.
Yeah. Were any of them involved in any of the operations?
Well, they were all on the board of directors.
Okay.
But they
not
had
day-to-day
no active participation.
But Barry Jr. was involved.
Now, Sally, later on, got involved in TV when we had gone over to the new building, but that was several years later. And I don't know if you ever read her tell-all book or not, but there's some interesting things in there too.
Yeah.
But
that was an interesting time, though. Wasn't
yes, it was. But I worked with Barry Jr. Quite closely because I was involved in we had established an FM station as well, WNNS FM, which was to be a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week news outlet.
Well, no, didn't they have a classical music station before that?
Nope. NNS came first.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and it didn't pan out.
Okay.
So it became a classical music station that Barry Jr. was very, very much involved in.
You remember when this was, what year that was?
Oh, golly. Now, you would ask me.
Was that still in the old building, or was that
the new building?
So that'd be in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. 68, 69.
So a news operation was the first, design for that.
And everybody said, this is not going to be practical. It won't support itself. There's no way.
They weren't as much concerned at, well, they were starting to get that way, but up until that point, they weren't particularly concerned about that.
They carried on the tradition of the days of Credo Fitz-Harris and back in the 20s and 30s, when there was an obligation to provide this service to the community.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at with the Bingham family. Yeah, that was kind of their attitude.
And their attitude was, if we happen to make money in the process, that's great.
Now, they made money from newspaper. They made a lot of money from television.
Newspaper was...
But the radio and television were pretty much
not exactly
public service, but it was a public...
Television became the cash cow after a while, but radio, to my knowledge, I don't think radio ever made any money. It broke even every now and again, but I think it was it was always a cash drain on the resources. But there again, there was this obligation. This is a service we provide to the community, and you know, if it costs, it costs. We do it. And they spared no expense either.
Yeah, obviously they didn't. Yeah. And took care of their employees well.
Absolutely,
too,
absolutely. With the exception of the retirement fund, we won't go there. And most of us learned way too late.
Too late. Wow.
But I have no regrets whatsoever for working for the Bingham family. I had a great deal of respect for them. I met Mr. Bingham Sr. on a couple of occasions, but he was rather standoffish. He was the patriarch. He was the former ambassador to England.
Even looked the role.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Impeccably dressed, Seville row suits. I mean, you know that. Well, Barry Jr. was not a slouch either.
No,
he dressed quite nicely.
But it was a change.
And sported the RAF mustache.
Yes, yes.
But a nicer man you would never want to meet.
Good.
He's just very down to earth, very, very wholesome individual who I enjoyed working with. I started to tell the story about when we went to FM.
Oh, yeah.
And the classical music format. We installed, at that time, one of the first automated broadcast systems. It was a Schaefer broadcast system based on a huge array of reel-to-reel playback tape machines. The brain, quote-unquote, which was this controller that was operated from a time clock device. There was no computers involved. There was no no programmed logic of any kind. This predates
yeah.
the real world.
This was 68, 69,
somewhere along in there. And it was the requirement of the engineer. We had revolving shifts, but at that time we were on 24 hours a day. And it was the responsibility of the engineers to load the program tapes in the right sequence on the right machines. We had an innovation at that time also. It was called a spotter. This was a two-deck reel-to-reel tape machine that held commercial announcements. And yes, we did. We had commercial time on the classical really? Station. And the way these things worked, some poor soul had to come in and sit for hours and record these one-minute commercials. And then you would take a razor blade, a cotton swab, and alcohol, and scrape the oxide off the tape in between each cut so that the optical sensor on the playback machine could tell when you'd hit the end of the commercial.
Talk about high tech.
Oh, that was grand stuff.
They said innovations. That's something that you all came up with, or was that a...
It was in cooperation with the folks at Schaefer. They developed this system, and we, to my knowledge, I think we were the first station to actually implement it and put it in. So we spent a lot of time corresponding with them and working out the bugs of the system. But I was going to dovetail this with my experiences with Barry Jr. Since that was his baby, he was the classical music freak, and he wanted to see that thing succeed. So it had better be right. Well, inevitably, things go wrong. I mean, with an automated system especially, sooner or later, something's going to get out of sync, and you're going to have the wrong announcement for the wrong piece of music. Or you're going to, since all the announcements were also pre-recorded on tape, and this brain switching device would alternately play the announcement tape and then play the appropriate music tape to go with it.
All guided by the little gaps in
yeah.
the...
Yeah. Oh, this was fantastic stuff. Yeah. Well, in order to assure that things happened more or less in a reasonable order, you had this, like a pegboard, installed in this... They called it the switching matrix. But you had to insert pins in this thing at the appropriate time for the appropriate channel.
So it just bypassed something.
Right. So when the little time clock would come up and go tick, whatever happened to be plugged into that slot, that's what started and ran. And hopefully it was the right thing at the right time. So you had this music sheet on which was indicated the time at each segment that this was supposed to play, and then you had to write in the number on the pegboard where you could set the little pins and the switches so that this would happen at the right place. Well, after a while, it got to be a routine thing. You could scan down the thing and take a glance. Yeah, it's all there. Everything's fine. It's ready to go. Once in a while, you'd get busy. We're now going to hear so-and-so, such-and-such by so-and-so. Silence would prevail. You know, well, we had a real handy little device attached to this equipment. It was called the silence sensor. If things got quiet for more than 30 seconds, you know, beep, it would warn you. You know, so you'd have to go see, you know, whoa, what happened? Well, generally, while programs were running like that, you were doing other things, like recording tomorrow's announce tape.
Sure.
So there again, you sat at the console, the announcer sat out in the studio, and you sat there, worked back and forth, and read these things. And so here he's reading what's going to happen, and beep goes off in your ear, and you, whoa, hold everything. So you run around, and you try to determine, oh, what happened here? You know, yeah, that's right. According to the sheet, that's supposed to be playing. Punch the button. Now the music is running.
Wow.
You know,
of course,
now you're a minute and a half off schedule.
Oh yeah.
Which means that you're going to run long when the segment comes up for the next time clock to go click. It's going to cut something off in midstream, and this is not going to sound good. Well, that happened a couple of times, and generally when it did, the phone would ring. This is Barry. Something seems to be wrong. yes, sir. I'm on top of it. We'll get it straightened out right now.
And he was always there.
He was always there.
Wow.
I think he listened probably 24 hours a day. He probably got some of it subliminally while he slept.
That's
but
amazing.
He was never harsh, never accusative. He'd always say, "I think something's gone wrong."
And he knew very well.
Oh, yeah.
Get it moving. Let's get it going here. Well, now, this was a big transition, though, to go from the elaborate studios you talked about. Now, they were very nice studios in the new building, but they were all representing a different era in broadcasting.
Exactly.
Scale studios. Well, you did have a couple of large, you had one or two large studios.
And in fact, the first DJ studio, Studio C, as it was called, was green, pale green painted, if you'll remember it. That was the original Studio C out of the other building.
Really?
They brought it part and parcel.
This was that big room?
They brought it part and parcel from the old building into the new building, and that became the first big studio. You also had the...
Did they use any live program? They didn't do bands? None of that came over there?
No. Okay. All that was long gone by the time we had moved over. We did do record shows out of there, DJ shows, but we still had an engineer playing the records for the DJ who sat out in that big empty studio, which was fun.
And you were in another room with a window looking in there.
Looking down into it.
Yeah, looking down into it.
Because we were elevated about 4 feet. But that was fun, too. We had the awards room, which later became WAMZ's on-the-air studio.
Even HAS was in there for a short while.
The reason for the awards room was that was where they brought the mommies and daddies of the kiddies that were going to be on TV show in the afternoons. And they had all the station awards around on the wall.
So everybody could see them
and be impressed. And they had the monitor there so that they could see little Joey when he was on TV later. Well, that function sort of went away with time, and we needed studio space. So when WAMZ, when WNNS and WHAS FM had finally transitioned into WAMZ and become a country music station, we needed a studio for it. So the awards room became the first WAMZ studio.
Now, I'm trying to remember something. WNNS was going to be the news thing.
Uh-huh.
Now, did that ever go on the air before the classical music, or did it not? No. So classical music went on, and then they moved from classical back to WNNS.
Yep.
And it tried to do a newscast for just a short while. This would have been in the middle 70s or
early
70s.
Early 70s.
Yeah, early 70s, yeah.
And
never
that,
worked.
That just didn't
so
work.
So that's when they went to WAMZ. It became a country music station.
And they had such success, quote unquote, with the automated system for the classical music that we moved it into the control room adjacent to the awards room. And WAMZ went on the air as an automated country music station with a live announcer.
Wow.
So it was...
In my mind, I'm just thinking Coyote Calhoun and that pegboard system. That's got to be a wild combination.
Well, Coyote never mastered the pegboard system. Fortunately, we still had engineers involved in the operations of it. But Coyote, he was a good sport about this whole thing because he had never...
And he was the DJ and the program director of WAMZ. Yeah.
Exactly. And he was never accustomed to live assist operation.
No.
Nobody was. I mean,
Coyote had come from Wacky a long time ago, and then it was a rock and roll disc jockey.
Yep.
He wanted to get into country.
Sure
was.
And to make the transition was a real chore on his part, but he handled it quite well. We'd load up all the prepackaged country music programs that he would be the DJ for. He'd be the announcer and all these things. He had to read the script because this is what's going to be played. That was just awfully galling because he had his ideas of what ought to be played, and, you know, this prepackaged just doesn't get it. So that didn't last too long until he finally prevailed and became the DJ.
That was a shift, too, even on WHAS AM, to go from... for a while there, when you moved to the new building, you still had operators doing production and playing the records.
Yep.
But that changed when? Probably in the early 70s, 71?
Wayne Perkey.
Okay. That would have been about 69 or something.
Yeah. Let's see. Wasn't there someone before? I think Wayne was the first.
Well, because DJ. I think then Hugh Barr came in, and he was starting to carve out WHAS Radio AM,
yep,
as opposed to the television station,
right,
and he hired Wayne and a news director,
yep,
and things like,
yep,
that. So that started that era then when disc jockeys came into
existence.
Even at that time, though, Wayne still had Harold Yarmer, you were somebody playing the records,
yep,
and then that began to shift, yep, I guess, as a result of union contract negotiations.
Well, not really so much as
just wanting to have more, just a different philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
More ad libs.
This was the industry standard,
sure,
quote unquote.
Yeah.
So that's what they went with.
Yeah, that was the
But
it was a transition, big transition.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was a relief for a lot of the engineers,
really,
because there's nothing more pressurizing than to be on the spot. You've got to have that record cued. You've got to have it ready to go. When he says the last word of whatever it is he's going to say and goes like that, you better let go.
Because the people listening don't know you're back there.
That's
they just know
right.
him, and he's quite worried about that.
That's
him
right.
or her.
His image is more important than yours.
Interesting.
It was still fun.
As that began to go away, did your duties change as the operator stuff began to go away? Did your duties change?
Yeah, because
AM radio.
Then
you did FM and radio.
A lot of the people who had been involved in radio operations were transitioning to TV. A lot were going in. In my case, we went into maintenance, engineering maintenance, and did more. Well, we did a lot of recording, too.
A lot more still. Equipment to take, or at least a different style. A lot,
yep,
more portable equipment, yep, and things like that.
Yep.
I assume it was new equipment moving into the new building.
Yep.
A lot of new equipment.
In fact, I transitioned first from radio into TV news. I did all the repair work on the Bell & Howell 16-millimeter cameras that the news people carried around.
They carried those around. Did film. Film.
Yeah. So that was real different.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Huh.
Wow. I was always interested in photography as an adjunct anyway, but that's a whole different world too.
Mm-hmm.
TV news is a real pressure cooker.
I bet.
And anything associated with it gets to be a real pressure cooker,
yeah,
too. So.
It became a lot more instant at that time,
yeah,
didn't it, as,
yeah,
opposed to everything scripted and brought down the hall in a roll,
yep,
tray. Now it's everything is instant and,
yep,
happening. And radio is like that,
yep,
now, more ad lib. And,
yep, exactly.
And the disc jockey on the air having more control of it and everything.
Yeah.
Well, you helped.
The philosophers say life is change.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, regardless of what the industry is, its life
is
changed.
So you never had a problem with that? I mean, you always...
Not really.
Was probably... You have an interest in a lot of things in life, so I'm sure that was kind of interesting to you.
Yeah.
You did a lot of transmitter work during this
time as
the years went on.
Which stood me in good stead.
Yeah.
After I retired, I started doing missionary radio work. Excuse me.
When did you retire, by the way, from WHAS?
1997. I retired at 60. My wife said, "Retire, or I'm going to divorce you." So, lesser of two evils.
Yeah. But that freed you up to do some other things.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Actually, even before I had retired, I had spent a couple of years working with the Southern Baptist Mission Board. A good friend of mine, David Daniel from Dallas, Texas. Who, by the way, had been a newsman at WBAP
in places. Dallas.
Yeah, was a missionary, and he had gone to Guatemala and spent 20 some odd years in Guatemala. And I got acquainted with him, sort of in a very strange way, by way of my brother-in-law, who is a Baptist minister. And on Sundays, we would, after church, usually go stop someplace to get a meal or a snack or something. And on one of those occasions, I made the mistake of saying, you know, I really, really would love to be doing something in a missionary line. I wonder if there's anything in like missionary broadcasting or something like that. He said, "I don't know, I'll find out." So nothing else was said about it. A couple of weeks later, I get this huge envelope in the mail from the Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Board welcoming me to
Wow.
The
you're
ranks.
In. You're in.
And he had signed me up. So I volunteered. And got to meet some people. At that time, we had a core group of engineers, mostly out of Texas. Texas is a hotbed of Baptist mission
and radio work. And television commission was strong there.
Yeah, it really was. I met a couple of fellows. David Daniel was one of them, and at that time he was the media director for missions in Guatemala. And he said, "We've just built a shortwave radio station here, and it reaches up into the states on a regular basis. You might want to try and listen for it sometime, see what it is." Well, it was TGVC was the call sign on 48-45 kilocycles. And in the wintertime, you could actually hear this thing all the way from Guatemala. It was only a 1,000-watt shortwave
the
station.
The signal would travel.
But it would travel. And I heard it several times and was really fascinated with this thing, you know. And so I told him about having listened to it and heard it. He said, would you be interested maybe in making a mission trip to the station just to see what the facilities are and see if there was anything that you could suggest in the way of maintenance and upkeep and what have you? And,
Yeah,
absolutely, you know. So I ended up making 12 trips to Guatemala over the years. And
he really volunteered you, didn't he?
Yes, he did. It stuck.
Yeah,
it took.
That's great.
I'd have to say that working under those kind of conditions, I mean, we were...
What were you doing?
One station was up in the rainforests. Guatemala's an interesting country. It's got 12 different climate zones. And 22 different indigenous people groups.
In a small place.
In a little place about the size of Illinois.
Yeah.
You know, fascinating place. So I got to see how radio used to be, because they make do with what they've got.
Mm-hmm. You were doing back building those army surplus.
Yeah, back to the good old days. Yeah. You know, radio like it used to be. I enjoyed that. So the shortwave station was located in a little place called Fray Bartolomo de las Casas.
All right.
Or they call it Las Casas for short, up in the rainforest of Guatemala, about 175 miles from Guatemala City, by real bad road, by the way.
Did you have a vehicle or did you have to go on mules?
Four-wheel drive is required, and even then that's not guaranteed, but there's always some walking involved. You learn to deal with that. But I got familiar with the shortwave station, and at that time they were wanting to branch into FM broadcasting because the young people, even in Guatemala, the young people are music-oriented, and they want to hear FM, estéreo FM. So the local Baptist churches got together and formed themselves a commission to study this, and they decided, this is something we need to do. We need to keep the young people interested in what we're doing. So they applied for a license. But this was about the time the Guatemalan Civil War was grinding down. My first trip down there, I was met at the airport by what looked like teenagers wearing military uniforms and carrying AK-47s.
Wow.
Which gives you pause to wonder.
From that client studio at WHAS.
Wasn't ever. But shortly thereafter, things got back to an even keel. But the government decided that they would allow indigenous people groups to have FM radio stations. So long and short of it is, I ended up making two trips down there, and we built an FM station to go along with the shortwave station. In fact, the first FM antenna was mounted on one of the towers that supported the shortwave antenna system up on a mountainside, which was kind of interesting, too. Towers, in the general sense only, they were vertical. they were sort of a support structure, and they held the antennas up. Outside of that, tower is not really an adequate description of these things, but that was fun. That was fun. In fact, that was probably my downfall, because several years later, my wife found a picture that the missionary had taken of me climbing those towers, and she said, "You don't climb."
Another ultimatum here.
You don't climb.
Wow, what a rich experience.
Oh, yeah.
You're not doing it yet? You haven't done that in a while?
Last trip was 6 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Not because I don't want to, and not because I don't think I can, but we've got other health issues in the family that I can't be away for any
What a fascinating time.
Yeah.
I want to come back to two quick things here. You mentioned your transmitter experience. You had a love for that. Tell us about the day. I remember maybe other experiences, but I remember the day that the tower out at by Flat Rock Road was blown over.
Yes.
And there's a 50,000 watt radio station with its tower laying down.
Yep.
And you guys, I think you were involved in this, weren't you, going about and getting it back on the air?
Well, actually, Charlie Newman was the keynote man in that mm-hmm. project. Charlie spent hour after hour after hour out there, but he and Paul Devine was involved in it too. I did the calculations for the temporary antenna, but they ended up stringing a piece of wire literally out the window of the transmitter building and running it out to an old tower in the front of the antenna site. And they operated on that thing for several months while the new tower was being built.
Joe Donovan, we interviewed Joe Donovan. He talked about being on the air, or was off the air, and then all of a sudden they're on the air with that wire running out, and getting a call from New Jersey saying, "We picked you up."
Yeah, which is kind of illegal, but you know, under emergency conditions, you can get away with that sort of thing.
But, well, I want to mention one other thing. You brought a book in with you. Yeah. People can't see this, but this is what's. Tell me about the book.
Well, this is called Microphone Memoirs, and it was written by Credo Fitch Harris,
who was
the first and original station manager for WHAS.
He was not still around when you came, was he?
No. He had deceased.
Had he really?
Yeah, okay. By then. And if you'll notice the frontispiece, the dedication.
To Robert Worth Bingham.
Yep.
Tell us about Robert Worth Bingham. That was one of the Bingham sons.
Yep. This was the original Robert Worth Bingham.
Oh, okay.
So he would have been the grandfather.
Oh, this is the grandfather. He was the father. Okay.
Yep.
Sure, it would have been. Yeah.
And the opening paragraph says, "When my friend, Judge Robert W. Bingham, publisher of two large and influential newspapers, later to become the American ambassador to England, telephoned me one peaceful April morning in 1922, there was evident, if restrained, excitement in his voice. 'What are you doing today?' he says. 'Finishing the ninth chapter of my next book,' I say. 'Have you seen the Courier Journal?' 'No.' 'Well, you may be aware of the fact that there is such a newspaper.' 'Vaguely,' he says. 'Then finish the ninth chapter. It's doubtful that it'll be terrific. Drop it off today if you can. Meanwhile, I've sent word that the Morning Courier Journal and the Steamer Edition, I'm not sure what the Steamer Edition is, will have the headlines, Radio Telephone Broadcast Station Starts.'"
Wow.
And that's how WHAS came into existence.
How about that?
This was in 1922.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. And he goes on, he has story after story and anecdote after anecdote about the early days of broadcasting WHAS. They were rather phenomenal, even for the time, because they went on the air with 500 watts, which was just incredibly powerful at the time.
At the time, sure.
Most stations then were 50 watts, 75 watts. And this was a 500-watt station.
That's amazing. Yeah.
He talks about the trials and tribulations of building a radio station in a newspaper building.
Sure. Press is running, as we talked about before.
It's a fascinating, fascinating history.
Microphone Memoirs.
Yeah.
Rio Fitch Harris. Very good. Well, that's a great way to end our interview. To come from, we started, you've shared some wonderful stories, Larry. Thank you. And you again, you were at WHS from 1964 to 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Anything you want to add? Any special memories?
And I've got a little plaque to prove it.
All right. Good. it would have hung in the awards room if they'd held on to
it. If they'd held on to it, yeah. That's
you have an awards room at home?
No. It's in the den.
Good. Very good. Well, thanks for taking the time. You've shared some wonderful stories.
Well, thank you.
I'm sure we'll think of more later on.
Oh, sure.
This is great. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.